Honesty compels me to tell you that I feel a bit uneasy here. Not that I'm not accustomed to speaking, but since I've come here, I haven't heard one good statement about seminaries. All the statements that, especially from Hinderley, that have come have been negative. The seminaries are awful and theologians are worse. And I just asked him to sit down for 1 minute because I wanted to tell him what he reminds me of. He reminds me of a letter that I received very recently. It was a letter in answer to a statement that I had made in our denominational paper, where I have a page called the Question Box once a month. And a number of letters have come in from people who seem to be worried that communists are infiltrating the church. All kinds of letters. So I just chose one as representative. Somebody who asked, wasn't the Revised Standard Version given us by the communists? You know, virgin was changed to maiden and so on. And I simply answered, no. Why don't you ask, how can you get them to read the Bible? That would be a better question. Well, now, in answer to that, I got a letter from a man in Michigan whom I've never met. 2 pages, handwritten, in which, first of all, he proved to me that 1/3 of the translators were actual communists. He quotes the Un-American Activities Committee, you know, Bishop Oxnam and so on. The other 1/3 were communistic sympathizers, at least, and he quotes John Birch literature. And the last 1/3, he says, must have been communist if they associated with the other 2/3. Now, it's his last 2 lines that remind me of Hinderley. I haven't given you those. Wait a minute. The last 2 lines were, even though you teach at a seminary, Mr. Strang, you are a skunk. Your brother... you are a skunk. Your brother in Christ, John James. Even though, Hinderley, I am a skunk, you're my brother still. And... I want you to remember that, and I think you would feel that way, too. Now, I'd like to get to our subject, education and transition, which is a very big subject, but I thought it might be of some help to you. I want, as a preface, to give you some experiences which prompt me to look into this a bit more deeply than I've ever done. I've given my life to education. Last week, just before I came, I heard Dr. George W. Weber. Who is he? I don't want to throw names around. Who's Dr. George W. Weber? The man who really began the East Harlem Parish. There's a book of his over in the bookstore, Congregation and Mission. He's usually called Bill Weber. He teaches at Union Seminary in New York at the same time that he works in East Harlem. Now, Union Seminary is considered one of the best, if not the best seminary in the country, has the most money. And I say this so you don't think that here's some little guy who's squirting off. I heard Dr. George W. Weber say, and he said it twice, lest we overlook it. He said, the most demonic institution which the Protestants invented is the Sunday school. May I repeat it too? The most demonic institution the Protestants ever invented was the Sunday school. Now, he does not include the Catholics. He may say the papacy is also a demonic institution, but we Protestants, we have one too. Now, I'm going to ask you next time, if you're still around, what you think he meant. It's very easy to throw out a statement like that. He defended it. But I'd like to know what you make of it. Why did he say this? He's going up and down the country. Gets over 1,000 invitations to speak a year. Why does he say this? The man who loves his church, has suffered for it, lives in East Harlem with his family. The other statement was made about 2 months ago. Now, this comes from a Lutheran theologian. G.W. Weber is not Lutheran. We happened to be in Chicago finishing up the new translation of Luther's Small Catechism. You have it now. It's called in Contemporary English. And we were having lunch, and across the table from me sat Dr. Martin J. Heineken, who many of you know, a first-class theologian from Philadelphia, about 65. Again, he's a mature man. He's been on the Theological Commission of the Lutheran World Federation, and we were talking about cooperating with Roman Catholics. And in our seminary, we happen to exchange credits now with a Roman Catholic institution, and I made some remark saying, I'm afraid we're going to be in trouble over this with some of our friends. And Heineken said, don't you worry about that. If they call the Pope the Antichrist, you tell them we got one too. And I said, Martin, what do you mean? We grew up together. And he said, you tell them we Lutherans, we have an Antichrist called the Bethel Series. I sort of choked over my fish a little bit. And next to him sat Dr. Alan Yassman from the Missouri Synod, who heads up, I think, all their Sunday school work. Again, a man with some ballast, you see. And I looked at him and he said, I couldn't agree with you more, Heineken. And what do you suppose I said? I said, gentlemen, may I quote you to my students? And they said, absolutely. What do you suppose they meant? Now, if this were Stokely Carmichael, you might not take it too seriously. But this is Heineken and Yassman saying we've got a Lutheran Antichrist that so many of our congregations are using. I assume that most of you know what the Bethel Series is, a special set of materials and approach, really, to studying the Bible in our parishes. Now, we can close our ears to this and simply move along, but that wouldn't be honest. Then, as I came out here, I was reading again the book that's quoted in this morning's newsletter, Marshall McLuhan's Understanding Media. And right in the front, he says that probably his major theme is, education today is programmed for discovery and not for instruction. I wish you'd chew on that for a while. Because most of us are engaged in some kind of instruction in the church. Education today is programmed for discovery, not for instruction. Quite a difference, and I'd like to have you tell me next time what you think he means. And then the fourth illustration, or the fourth prefatory mark. This also happened last month in July. I heard a Roman Catholic father, not a very famous man, Kiesling was his name, happened to be speaking in our chapel, say with rather deep emotion. He said, I certainly wish that 450 years ago our Roman Catholic Church would have listened to Luther. He said, think of the suffering that could have been avoided. Then he went on. And I did try to think of it. Suppose they had listened. No 30 years war, if you know some of the agony of that. Try to think of the anguish of mixed marriages for 450 years, where he was a Catholic and she was a Protestant, and 2 o'clock in the morning they argued and the poor kid suffered. Endless. could have been avoided if 450 years ago they'd listened to Martin Luther the way they do today. And my reaction was, now, we are, I believe, in the midst of a great Reformation today. It's different than Luther's, but I personally believe it's just as great. Suppose we don't listen. And 450 years from now, they'll say, why didn't they listen? The world could be so different. And that's why I'm not at all apologetic in inviting you to listen with me as best as we can to what the men in the renewal movement are saying about our Reformation today, what they are suggesting. Now, whether we accept everything they say or not is our responsibility. But you can't accept or deny something that you don't really understand. And my purpose here is to help you clarify the issues just a little bit. In making decisions, you and I will often be wrong. That's all right. But if you fail to make decisions, you're always wrong. And our job here is to make the decisions which are most responsible for your and my life. Now, what are some of the emphases? This morning I'd just like to posit a few of these so you can start thinking about it. If you want some others discussed where I can help you, fine. If you want to ask about Augustine's view of grace, don't do it here because I don't know enough about it. But if you want to find some help, for instance, is Hugh Hefner saying something worthwhile? I have his document with me, one of his best. The best document on the God is Dead movement appeared in Playboy. I have a Xerox copy just of those pages, if you... Now, why does Hugh Hefner get involved in this, you see? And to say, God is dead, oh no, but he is risen. It doesn't solve anything. Doesn't even hear what those men are saying. If you want to read something that may spoil your sleep even at Holden Village, read what a lot of other Americans are reading. Well, you can't talk to people unless you know where they are. And you go down here at the airport in Seattle and it's there. A little paperback called After Auschwitz, written by Rabbi Rubinstein. Now, it touched me because Rubinstein had very much the kind of background that I had. Very religious. His father was a rabbi. His mother was a wonderful believer and so on. He mentions this. And he had some relatives die at Auschwitz, so he goes over there just to look this up, and then he gets quite involved and he writes a book on it. You know, you trace the relatives that are still living and some people who survived. And he writes a rather dramatic account of Auschwitz. You know what he says in the last page? I began this study a firm, devout believer. I ended with the honest confession that now I believe there is no God. There can't be a God. And still look down on Auschwitz and Dachau and Bergen-Belsen and permit this. And if there is a God, he's not the kind I want. Now, I quote this because usually we think the Jews are the most firm believers, you know. It wasn't Khrushchev. This was a devout rabbi. Now people are reading that. You pick it up in the drugstore. Now to shout to them, oh, but he is risen, Matthew says. This doesn't take hold at all. Not at all. Now how does this affect our education? Someone here mentioned to me walking out of the refectory, that how hard it is to talk to young people today in any kind of Christian education class. I know it. I'm not going to listen if you just shout, "But he is risen." That settles it. I learned when I was 5 years old. Or as Billy Graham, I talked to him this morning. How does he know? He talked to God. Now, that would be one of them. I'd be very happy to discuss this with you, the God is dead movement, which only the fool, I think, says is dead. There'll be more books like After Auschwitz. One of the emerging emphases that I think our good brother Herb is getting into is this very broad emphasis on the laity. Now, I grew up as a Lutheran, and I preached at Reformation time on the priesthood of believers. I don't think I know what it really meant until recently. Some of you heard me say it yesterday. The World Council has just counted 1,413 books have appeared on the laity recently. What are they saying that Luther didn't say? The man who talked about the priesthood of believers. They're saying something that goes far beyond Luther. I think Luther understood it in principle, but he never really put it into practice. And this is what we've suffered under for 450 years. That's why we need another Reformation. We can discuss God is dead movement, the emphasis on the laity. We can discuss what is meant by the phrase that thrown about so much, holy worldliness or secular religion. Now, of course, you can say, I'm going to study what the Gnostic said in the book of Galatians. It's all right. But we're living in 67. What are these people saying? I suffer under this a little bit. To think that there is a book today that many have not read, yet it has been printed in more copies than any book in the church's history except the Bible in 1900 years. And this appeared in your and my lifetime. Now, I can ignore it. What book is it? Honest to God by Bishop Robinson. Agree with it or not, but you've got to decide. I happen to think it's a real manifesto. And if it isn't, I still have to ask myself, why did more people buy that book? I don't know of any church that said buy it, that pushed it. I don't know of any church that did it. And yet people bought it in more copies than any other book in the church's history. Why? Well, I suppose they were hungry for it. That's why people buy books like that. Because somebody told his brother or sister, you've got to read this. This guy doesn't talk like preachers. He's got something to say to me. Now, of course, we can live in this decade and simply ignore it. But I'd say that we're vegetating. And how can I talk to the fellow next to me on the plane who might be reading Honest to God? And I say, no, I never look at that. I only read Luther. I think I've closed the gate. If the boys from last night will excuse me. And the closest I ever got talking to a man on the plane was recently, a businessman from Cleveland, because he was reading Report to Greco, which I had just finished by Cousin Zakis, the man who wrote Zorba the Greek. A marvelous book. His search for God. He tries everything. Women, monasteries, everything. But he's searching for God. And this fellow was reading it. And he asked me, and what else are you reading? And I said, Human Sexual Response by Johnson and so on. And then he put down his book. He's going to stop in and see me. Because he's got trouble with his wife. Would have never happened if I'd ask him, what do you think of Luther's Small Catechism? Now, this is what people are reading, and you know this is a good, sound educational principle. sound, because Paul Tillich builds his whole theology on this, a correlation. You don't just talk. You correlate with what people themselves are thinking. You answer questions. I don't want to get ahead of myself here, but the best philosophy of education that I've ever heard is from Tillich. Some of you have taught Sunday school. What are you trying to do? Just hand out information. Now, boys and girls, who is Abraham? They couldn't care less, really. And this might be part of that demonic institution. I can't picture Jesus walking around saying, boys and girls, how many books are in there? Bible. How many prophets? Who are the major prophets? Come on, Johnny, sit still. Who are the major prophets? It's demonic, ladies and gentlemen. No wonder the church is dead. What are you trying to do in Sunday school? Paul Tillich was asked that, well, he says in an article, I've struggled with this, and he gives an answer which I think is sort of beautiful. It doesn't solve everything. But he says, in Christian education, you answer the questions people have. And then you lead them to ask such questions which only the gospel can answer. Entirely turned around. Completely turned around. The only thing wrong with that definition is that I didn't think of it first, really. It's quite a different definition than I've operated with most of my life in Sunday school. You've got to cover these three books in confirmation class. Where does Jesus say you've got to cover three books? Lots about Jonah. It's all right. I don't think the boys down in Seattle, if I went down the street this morning and told them we settled the problem of Jonah, that they'd all come around and listen. Isn't what they're worried about. There are tremendous changes today in education. We can ignore them, I think, to our own loss. Now, this holy worldliness, this secular religion, for one who grew up, I don't want to say in a pietistic home, it was pious, but for one who grew up in a different tradition, I've had to unlearn so much. This has been traumatic for me. There was a time I was ready to give up my seminary job. I think I'm beginning to catch on what Bonhoeffer meant by holy worldliness. Now, that does not mean that I can do as I please. Quite different. Secular religion. You read Daniel Jenkins. Secular religion. First page. Beautiful. I don't know what to do, he says. When I go to church, I have a bad conscience for going through the motions. Page 15, everybody. When I don't go, I have a bad conscience because my brethren may need me. So what am I to do? We, and I speak of the ALC here, we have Lutheran seminary professors who didn't go to one single Lenten service because they said, I'm a worse Christian for going and hearing all about Judas and Peter, how awful they were. I'm going to stay at home. Well, those are honest men, ladies and gentlemen. One of them refused to send his children to Sunday school. He says they're worse off than they were before. Now, this is you're in my church, you see. Again, we can ignore it. And 450 years later, somebody will say, why didn't they listen? We can go into the new morality, which is certainly a part of education in transition. It changes the whole approach of our ethics, you see. I would really like to discuss this with you because I think, first of all, there's a lot of fuzzy thinking. When a man writes in a denominational paper last month that according to the new morality you can do as you please, he's a liar. Simply not true. Not even Hugh Hefner says that. And certainly the theologians like Fletcher are saying something quite different. And I think the reason we say that is because we don't really want to hear what they are saying. Because I consider the new morality or situational ethics, which I equate, as much more difficult than anything I ever grew up on. Well, let me give you one story. Maybe this will whet your appetite. I hope it will. From Fletcher's situational ethics, this is sort of considered the story that is supposed to summarize his book and may give you a touch of what the new approach is about. Now, this is the story that's usually taken out of his book. It concerns a woman who was caught in the East Zone. You know, August 13th when the wall went up. And she was caught over there, and her husband and three little children were on the west side. Well, you can't get together, you know, once the wall is up. So she was taken to a concentration camp in the East Zone, wherever they kept those people. And she heard by the grapevine that her husband and the family was just about breaking up. Her husband was one of these impractical guys like I am who can't fry an egg. And the kids were running around all over, and the father had to work, and she worried about this. So she inquired, how in the world can I get out and go to my family? Well, there are only two ways you can get out of the East Zone, a woman. One of them is to get real sick, and they don't want to bother the sick, and they'll ship you home. And she said, well, maybe I can worry myself into a good case of TB or something, but why go home and die? That didn't help anybody. The other way a woman can get out is to become pregnant. They don't want to bother with pregnant people. So, after a lot of deliberation and meditation and prayer, get this, she had herself impregnated by a German guard, East German guard. And when the MD said she's pregnant, she was sent home to the West Zone. Well, after 9 months, the baby came, and they went to the Lutheran pastor, and he had a service of thanksgiving that she had done such a Christian thing, and they baptized the baby. And they said, this baby is almost like a little Christ. He's brought us together again. He has reconciled the family. Did she break the commandment? What is it, 6? Thou shalt not commit adultery? Well, of course she did. Did she do right or wrong, however? You think that over till next time. I've made up my mind on this illustration. There's something more important than Exodus 20 and laws, you see. Jesus didn't talk much about laws. According to the new morality, she did the right thing. As of this moment, I feel the same way. There is something more important than a commandment. And that's what? That's love. Now, there are all kinds of problems. What if she led that boy into a life of prostitution and so on. I don't know. All I know is she did probably the hard thing for a good mother, and she did it out of love. Now, these are the problems that the new morality struggles with, you see. These are real problems. That's one thing I like about this whole renewal movement. Some of the favorite words are, it's gutsy, it's visceral. By that is meant it gets down to earth. When I was at the seminary, we spent a whole hour on the question, if a couple with a baby is lost in the desert, can they baptize it with sand? Who cares? Who cares? It was so artificial. Now, here's a real problem. If you had been that woman, you try to put yourself into that. Or the husband. I want my wife to come back pregnant and welcome her. The choices aren't always, you know, black and white. And finally, what is your principle, your criterion, from the viewpoint of the Christian faith? There's the question of the death of the perish. Now, we can avoid this. That's the easiest because, after all, we're trying to reach our budget and all that sort of thing. But you see, the voices are just too many and too strong. Maybe I should have said at the beginning, I'm not too much interested in listening to one little voice somewhere. When one man says, if we can just get a good modern liturgy, we've saved the church. I don't put too much stock into that. But when 150 say the same thing, theologians, leaders, men of stature, then I'm going to say, well, what are they saying? There must be something to this. Now you just have from Bonhoeffer on down or up, whichever way you want to go, talking about the death of the parish. For 1,000 years, ladies and gentlemen, the Christian church didn't have any parish. So don't say this is heresy. And now when our whole culture and mode of living is changing, do you have to keep the parish like a kerosene lamp? Do you want people driving by someday, as we do with the Amish in Iowa, and say, see what they look like? Oh, they're odd people, aren't they? These Christians with their little museum and a steeple on it. Aren't they odd people? They just haven't caught up with 1960s, you see. Is the parish necessary in order to have Christian church? This is a tough one. You just can't picture the Christian church without some parish in a building, can you? Does faith need a temple? Not really. Except when it snows, you gotta have a roof. When it's cold, you gotta have a furnace. But for myself, I can no longer take money out of my separated portion and give it for a church building. I have anything to do with the kingdom of God. That's so I can stay warm. No more than I can take out of my separated portion to buy a heater in my car to get me to church. The church building has nothing to do with the kingdom of God, really. Shall we take Stephen Rose's suggestion and Bishop Pike's and the church sell every last bit of property? It just might be the salvation of the church. What would you do if you didn't have a building? Well, you'd have to go to your neighbor and say, John, let's sit down and study our Bible. And you might end up getting a loaf out of a jar somewhere and having communion. You try it. That means more to me than artificial little wafer. When I get a loaf of bread with some jelly on it, that's sacred. More sacred than a wafer that was made in Milwaukee by some deaconesses. Jesus used a loaf of bread, I'm sure he did. What do we mean? Is this death of the parish really important and so on? I'll be happy to discuss this if you want to. I should think it would have meaning for you. The question of pietism versus servanthood. Now, maybe these phrases are a little bit new to you, but when you hear somebody talk about religiosity with a sneer, you know, now what does he mean? Is he making fun of my faith? Probably not. Probably, he isn't making fun of Jesus Christ, but he's just making fun of the way I think my life ought to be lived and the phoniness with which it is saturated. That's what he's sneering at. Quite a difference between, this phrase comes from a man by the name of Gibson Winter, very fine Episcopalian, who I think has made the best definition between the two. Now, yesterday we prayed in the service, page 15, for pious, what is it? I didn't write it down. Somebody help me. In the liturgy for pious souls, something like that. We pray for piety. Piety. Now, piety and pietism are two different things. The distinction may not be pleasant for some of us. It wasn't for me. I've had to give up so much. And I'm sure I'll give up more. I think a part of this whole transition is another emphasis of the renewal movement called the affirmation of creation. This is one of the hard things for us to learn. And I'd like to share with you a little bit what a Roman Catholic Jesuit priest by the name of Teilhard de Chardin has said about this, because I think he really started it. He wasn't aware of it, but has probably given us more in this area that most of my life I've been fighting creation. You know, the awful scientist, we even talked about evolution, fight him. And that the president of the Lutheran World Federation can go around from one district to another in 1967 and talk about sanctification? No. Justification? No. He talks about sexuality. A big shot. He's learning that God's creation is a gift. In fact, this comes first. You know, one of the toughest times I've had, it took me 6 months just to catch on what they meant. But I think I have an inkling now. When so many of these men are saying, don't stress the church so much. The Bible doesn't say much about God loving the church. He loved the world. I would have turned this around. God comes to the church, especially my church, and then he wants to serve the world through. No, no, no. God loved the world. It doesn't mean much to you right now, unless you're extremely brilliant, but you watch 6 months from now, it's like learning how to play pinochle or something. You catch on that God's major love is for his world. Now, within this world, there's a little group that calls itself the church. And this is a bunch of servants that serve God in this world. Now, Rome's learning it. He didn't run away from this world by going to the monastery. And Jacqueline Grennan says, let's take our college and sever connections with the church. We belong to the world. But it takes us so long to catch on, I think, as to what they're trying to say. And this is a part of this whole affirmation of creation. It's beautiful. When Teilhard de Chardin is lost in the desert, Jerusalem, well, not really lost, but out there speaking to a convention, and as a priest, got to have communion. So he takes the elements of nature and has communion and describes that. It's beautiful. The subject of ecumenism, which may be so far removed from us here, but let me tell you, anything you say in the there are no Christian classroom, but in the classroom of the church, in Christian education, if you want to call it that, whether this is 8-year-olds or 80, anything you say that isn't globally applicable to all Christians just isn't worth saying. You're behind the times. It's too late already. And this emphasis on ecumenism, you know what ecumenism is. And I'd like to throw another subject out to you. You think about it. If a youngster in the classroom, I don't care where it is, asks you, now, what's distinctive about the Lutherans or the Methodists or whatever you are? What answer would you give? Now, be careful. If there's anything I don't like, it's these easy answers. The Lutherans believe they're saved by grace. So do the Methodists. The Lutherans sing. So do others. The Lutherans have a liturgy, so the Episcopalians. What's distinctively Lutheran? If there isn't much left, you have no right to exist, or Methodist, or Episcopalian. Now, you grind this down. I just had to speak on this, the International Parish Ed Committee, and, you just don't throw out easy answers. What's left? Now, I'd like to sort of end up with this, if we can, because I think, again, there's some confusion here. I think we have something to contribute to this thing called ecumenism. But I hope it's the right thing. Don't say Lutherans believe in their confessions. Presbyterians thought enough of it to work out a new one in 67. So we're not the only ones. Now, what is distinctively Lutheran? It's a certain combination of things. Well, that isn't very helpful. Then somebody else gets that combination. Is there anything distinctively Lutheran today? The real presence? No. Other churches who believe in the real presence, they don't always use the same words, you know. What's left? I happen to think there are a few things left. And I'd like to share those with them. One of the most urgent and most contemporary questions in Christian education and in theology is what is called the question of revolution. Now, some of you, if you read your Sunday paper, and I hope you didn't overlook it, will recall that there was a big meeting, an important meeting in Geneva last summer on church and society. I think it'll go down in history as one of the most provocative meetings ever, called by the World Council of Churches. Now, we're in it, most of us. And what are they worried about? They're not worried about the thing that I heard when I was a boy, and I heard a preacher read a paper on bobbed hair, whether women should cut their hair, you know. After all, the Bible says they shouldn't. No. What did they discuss? The word that was used most frequently at that meeting was the word revolution. Revolutionary. What are they saying? Ladies and gentlemen, I'd certainly like to avoid this decision, but I got to make it. The question is, when there's a dictator somewhere under whom 1,000,000 or 100,000 people suffer, shall we as Christians go in and throw him out, even kill him? I don't give an easy answer. Peter, put away your sword. Doesn't settle it. The question is, which is worse? To kill that man and help 1,000,000? That's your alternative. Why? Well, we honor Niemöller, Bishop Lirier, Bonhoeffer. They're almost saints. What'd they do? They planted a bomb next to Hitler. They're little Hitlers today. And the question arises, and I heard a student of ours ask Bishop Lelia this spring, you heard him. No, yeah, you were at seminary. No, you. He spoke at your seminary. Ask Lelia, the grand old man, said Lelia, now that you've had time to think it over, would you do it over as a Christian bishop to plant a bomb next to your leader? And Lelia said, not only would I do it over, my friend, I would try to do it earlier. That's your choice. Can we as Christians stand by when a dictator puts 100,000 people in jail? Let them starve to death. Is our job to start a revolution? Brother, this is a tough one. I just as soon avoid it. But it isn't very Christian to avoid issues. A church, Bonhoeffer said, which avoids politics, or worse still, uses politics, will never speak to secular man. Go ahead, you become a little in-group somewhere, but modern man isn't going to listen to you unless you get involved in this. And it's so beautiful. A church which avoids politics, that's awful. This is one of the big issues in our country. People are saying, even saying, I won't give my money because my church is getting into politics. Luther was in it every day, and Calvin still more. Or worse still, uses politics. I'll run for the school board to get in a lot of Lutherans. You know, that's awful. We'll never speak to secular man. Now, you may speak, but nobody listens. Well, I thought I'd close with a poem this morning. Preacher's got to close with a hymn, you know. Well, it is a little different. I hope you don't think that my emphasis is too strong and so on. I want to read to you a little poem from a man whose ashes are being scattered this morning, I understand, in Galesburg, Illinois. Carl Sandburg. When I read last Sunday that he died, I decided to bring this along. Carl Sandburg, gentle old soul, wasn't he? The Associated Press called him the typical American. That was beautiful. He talks about Lincoln, he describes Chicago just the way it is. Oh, typical American, plays his guitar. And he wrote a little poem to the church. Now, the fact that he didn't have a church funeral doesn't bother me too much, but what he said about it. This is from Sandburg, talking to church leaders. I guess that's you and me, huh? It's entitled "To a Contemporary Bunk Shooter." You come along tearing your shirt, yelling about Jesus. Where do you get that stuff? What do you know about Jesus? Jesus had a way of talking soft, and outside of a few bankers and higher-ups among the con men of Jerusalem, everybody liked to have this Jesus around because he never made any fake passes and everything he said went, and he helped the sick and gave the people hope. You come along squirting words at us, shaking your fist and calling us all damn fools so fierce the froth slobbers over your lips, always blabbing we're all going to hell straight off and you know all about it. I've read Jesus' words. I know what he said. You don't throw any scare into me. I've got your number. I know how much you know about Jesus. He never came near clean people or dirty people, but they felt cleaner because he came along. It was your crowd of bankers and businessmen and lawyers hired the sluggers and murderers who put Jesus out of the running. I say the same bunch backing you nailed the nails into the hands of this Jesus of Nazareth. He had lined up against him the same crooks and strong-arm men now lined up with you paying your way. This Jesus was good to look at, smelled good, listened good. He threw out something fresh and beautiful from the skin of his body and the touch of his hands wherever he passed along. You slimy bunk shooter, you put a smut on every human blossom. In reach of your rotten breath, belching about hellfire and hiccuping about this man who lived a clean life in Galilee. When are you going to quit making the carpenters build emergency hospitals for women and girls driven crazy with wrecked nerves from your gibberish about Jesus? I put it to you again. Where do you get that stuff? What do you know about Jesus? I guess time's up.